So this is our Huie reading group continuing our reading of Cybernetics and the Origin of Information. We're on page 40 of the translation, still in chapter 1. So we're still looking at the different types of information machines that existed at the time he was writing this book in the 50s, and then I think second edition in the 60s. We've seen a very sort of high level sketch of the functioning of a digital computer in terms of, you know, Boolean operations on these, you know, 0 and 1 bits. You can like translate any sort of complex proposition into a set of operators like and, or if then, that are applied to truth values of simple propositions. So you just set the simple propositions to either 0 for false or 1 for true. You combine them using these operators, and then you can, each operator has rules for calculating what the truth value of a complex proposition built using that operator is based on these truth values of the simple propositions that make it up. So what the sort of like the key property of this sort of way of building up complex propositions that Huie wants to emphasize is that it's completely divorced from any sort of grasp of the meaning of these propositions. Like, it doesn't, you can have two sentences that are about completely different topics and have no relation to each other in terms of semantics. They might have the same logical structure in the sense that you can decompose them into simple propositions that are combined using the same operators. And for the purposes of calculating truth values, these two sentences are completely equivalent. So this is like the sort of digital computer, which is now, of course, the main form of computation that we're all familiar with. But at that time, so the time he's writing, there was widespread use also of analog computers. So essentially the idea is that you have some sort of continuous process. So for example, like an electrical current that can be, where the voltage can vary continuously and not just in a off or on manner. And you set up this system in such a way that the dynamics of the system, the sort of electronic model, or sometimes it's a mechanical model or whatever, doesn't have to be electronic, but your sort of model system mirrors the dynamics of the system you're actually interested in, like figuring out, simulating or modeling. So I've heard of one that allowed for predicting tides. So it had some sort of, I think it might have been a mechanical one, if I remember correctly. So it had some sort of system of like gears and pulleys or whatever that you could sort of, enter like a time in the future. And it would sort of calculate what level the tide would be at that time. But it would do so just by, you know, rotating gears and so on, rather than sort of entering a number and operating on a number in a digital way. There's also one that he mentions in this book that is sort of like a simulation of a electrical power distribution system. So you can look at like, what would happen if this power plant were damaged and could only output 30% of its normal power? You know, how would that affect the distribution of electrical power across this network? Maybe between these different cities or whatever. Would that lead to power outages somewhere or whatever? So these types of analog computers were in widespread use at this time as well, though now they've been mostly replaced by digital computers. And he also looks at a few, could call maybe like cybernetic computers. So these are ones that incorporate some sort of feedback operation. So he talks about this artificial tortoise that Gray Walter had designed, which has a couple different feedback mechanisms built into it. So it's like a little sort of, similar to like a remote control car that kids play with today. And it has a photoelectric cell, so a light sensitive sensor that allows it to orient toward the light source. But it is set in such a way that it orients towards the light source, but if the light is too bright, it will orient away from the light. So it's only a sort of moderate intensity of light that it is attracted to. And it also has a sort of sensor that monitors the level of charge in its battery. And the sort of environment of this device is set up in such a way that there are charging stations that are attached to a light source. So the when the robot or, you know, artificial tortoise is sort of orienting towards a light source, it is like by virtue of that orienting towards a charging station, and the feedback of the battery sensor is connected to the light orientation mechanism. So its sort of degree of aversion for intense light diminishes as its charge in its battery diminishes. So when the battery is close to fully charged, it will avoid intense light sources. But then as the battery becomes more and more decharged, or like the charge level in the battery is lower, then it will actually orient towards the light sources that earlier it might have avoided. And so the idea is this sort of simulates like the sort of hunger mechanism in a living organism, in an animal of some kind, that would, so an animal that potentially in certain situations would avoid, say like an exposed environment where a predator could catch it. It might avoid a food source that's in this sort of exposed setting. But then as it becomes hungrier and hungrier, the risk of being caught by a predator is outweighed by the need to eat something. So that's sort of like a simplistic model of this kind of interaction between, say, hunger and avoiding danger. And then the sort of third like mechanism in this device is that it has a tactile sensor at the front of the of this, you know, little robot. So if it runs into an obstacle, so this tactile sensor will detect the fact that it has run into an obstacle, and that sort of disengages the orientation mechanism in, connected to the photoelectric cell. So what that means is that once it runs into an obstacle, it just sort of moves around randomly. It, you know, goes to the left and right randomly until it sort of just by chance gets around the obstacle. And then once the photo, once the tactile sensor is no longer engaged, then the photoelectric cell reconnects to the orientation mechanism. So it starts to head towards the light again. So it might start by moving towards the light, but there's some sort of obstacle between it and the light source. So it just runs into that. Then it just starts moving around randomly until it gets around the obstacle. Then it starts going towards the light source again. So this is sort of like simulating a sort of very simple behavior of something like a worm, or I think a worm might be like the best example, where it just sort of goes in a certain direction, doesn't have any sort of like planning of its route to avoid an obstacle. It just sort of goes until it hits something, then moves around till it gets around that obstacle, and then restarts on that same path toward the source that is trying to reach. So it has these like three very simple mechanisms that are connected to each other in different ways, but as a result of the connections between these simple mechanisms, this artificial tortoise can reproduce like at least a simulation of sort of simple animal behavior that is quasi-realistic. It's similar to animals, you know, hunger and risk aversion kind of interaction. And then I think the last type, the last example of a information machine that we discussed last week was these homeostats that I believe it was Ashby who put these together. Ashby. The construction of how exactly they work is not that relevant, but the idea is that you have sort of second order feedback. So you have different feedback mechanisms that are linked to each other in such a way that they can sort of adjust each other's operation in such a way as to preserve a certain state in like a dynamical sense. So you can have four components of this system that each have their own, you know, functioning, and they, because they're linked together in this way, they eventually reach a kind of equilibrium, and then you can sort of intervene in the device and like change the way that one of these components operates. You can like reverse its feedback sort of properties, and then that sort of throws the whole thing out of equilibrium. It sort of will sort of oscillate and move around in various ways until finally the other three components will sort of bring about an adjustment in such a way as to bring the whole system made up of these four components back into an equilibrium, probably at a different level than what it was before. So it's a kind of self-stabilizing system. It like preserves equilibrium, not just by like a simple negative feedback operation, but in this dynamic sense, because it can actually sort of adjust to different different ways of functioning of its own components. They can sort of adjust for each other's changes. So this is actually pretty, I mean, again, this is a fairly simple, it's just like four sort of electronic components that you could probably buy at like a Radio Shack or something in the 1950s. So it's not like anything very sophisticated. There's no obviously AI or anything like that that's governing this process. But it also, it does sort of, again, sort of simulate at least some processes that you can observe in physiology in living organisms, in animals specifically. So he compares this talks about the comparison that some especially Gestalt psychology people had made of this kind of sort of dynamic equilibrium or dynamic restoration of equilibrium with some physiological processes that happen when one of these sort of classic experiments was taking a monkey and reversing the connections of the eye muscles so that like the muscle that normally would move the eye to the left now moves the eye to the right and vice versa. So of course, right after this, you know, switching of the muscles is done, the eye movements of the monkey are sort of disorganized so that if it's like tracking an object moving to the left, the eye will move to the right and then miss the object, of course. I don't know exactly how long, but fairly quickly, the sort of fixating process where to track an object moving across the visual field adjusts to the reversed eye muscles in such a way as to track the object correctly. So of course the monkey doesn't have like a sort of built-in mechanism for like, just in case someone switches your eye muscles, then use this mechanism to track objects in the opposite direction. It's something that is completely foreign sort of intervention into the functioning of a monkey's eye tracking mechanism, but it has this sort of dynamic stabilization property that it like after this intervention that disrupts things, it like sort of settles back into a kind of stable condition of being able to track objects properly. Even though this is an intervention that is, there's no reason to think that, you know, the monkeys would have like evolved some sort of built-in mechanism to like compensate for this kind of intervention, which of course would never have happened in their evolutionary history. This like very simple electronic homeostat device is sort of simulating this seemingly pretty sophisticated physiological process of, you know, this like dynamic adjustment of this sort of weird switching of eye muscles and you know, changes to the way the components function. He hasn't really given a specific argument for this, but each of these like sort of more and more sophisticated kinds of information machine, Ruyer is going to say, yes, these are actually very sophisticated and very interesting, but they don't actually sort of get us to cognition and understanding as they exist in animals and human beings as well, and all living beings actually for Ruyer, they sort of simulate certain aspects that help us maybe understand how cognition works, but they are not actually, this is not what cognition itself really is. They aren't sort of telling us that. They're sort of like approximations to cognition, but they are not actually qualitatively the same kind of thing as real cognition in real animals. So I think we can stop here for the sort of intro part, but so we can go start the reading itself. If someone would like to pick up from the heading conditioning and learning.
I can read. Conditioning and learning. Can an automaton be conditioned? Can it learn to take into account experience so as to behave not only according to immediate results, but in the same way as Pavlov's dogs, according to previous results obtained? Could it, for example, learn to react to sound after having been set up, monté, to react to light, if sound were to replace light as a signal relative to the intended purpose? All the cyberneticians are confidently addressing this important issue. Fully understand the difficulty of the problem they want to solve. It is necessary to understand that learning does not consist in behaving, even with flexibility, according to a feedback system. Learning is essentially about setting up a new feedback system. What is learning to drive a car? It is essentially to set up cerebral feedback that is optico-motor, for handling the steering wheel, and audio motor for using the accelerator and gear stick. Novice drivers flood their engine or let it stall because they want to use a more quote-unquote natural feedback based on kinesthetic sensations, sensations that are insufficiently precise to inform the foot position accurately through a recurrent circuit. When the auditory information about the engine speed directly controls the position of the foot on the accelerator, the learning is normally completed. However, as we have seen, an automaton could be set up to drive a car. A radar or photoelectric cells could inform the steering effectors. An acoustic device could inform the acceleration effectors or tiered effectors for changes of speed. Moreover, as we have seen, like a good driver, the automaton could switch from one automobile to another, whose steering is more or less augmented, or the accelerator more or less sensitive, since it would guide itself by the result obtained. But we must be careful of an ambivalence. This quote-unquote transfer from one car to another would not be a real transfer, a learning experience. The automaton would not learn to drive. It would be set up for this performance. It would not set itself up. It would not constitute the appropriate feedback for itself, like the human learner. It would not transpose the kinesthetic motor feedback into a more effective audio motor feedback. It is like the modification or improvisation of an assembly montage through practice, and not the functioning of an assembly, even allowing for improvised effects, that constitutes learning. It is true that Ashby's homeostat really seems to answer the problem. It modifies the assembly of its own feedback when it seeks its goal, despite having a defective assembly to begin with. Ashby considers that his machine can explain why, in living species, feedback is set up correctly and not the wrong way. Natural selection had to eliminate, for example, a species in which lowering the body temperature would trigger a further cooling perspiration instead of a warming shiver. It could also explain how individual experience can correct feedback that would not be appropriate in a certain context, particularly by changing its sign, positive or negative. A child may be compelled to learn to look for a red blanket but avoid a red ember. The details of this fine-tuning cannot depend on the action of natural selection, because different children in different circumstances can be adapted to different feedback arrangements. The homeostat can precisely correct feedback that is set up the wrong way. But what Dr. Ashby forgets is that the uniselectors of his machine only choose between the assemblies inherent in the circuits. They do improvise a new behavior and equilibrium, but they do not improvise a new assembly. If the experimenter has reversed a feedback, quote, the uniselector then changes this feedback for another by searching for one after another among the randomly arranged feedback until it finds one that fits. Once found, this feedback is retained, unquote. We know that in conditioning experiences, on the contrary, anything can be used as a conditional stimulus. When the dog learns to salivate on the beat of a metronome or on the application of an electrical current to its paw, it is difficult to believe that a brain selector could have just chosen between, quote, nervous feedbacks prone to chance, unquote. To this objection, one could reply that in the cortex, there is a large enough number of neurons and conductors that the selection can always seem improvised. But then all the weight of the difficulty is transferred to the biological organization, which did not simply have to choose between ready-made assemblies. It's a pretty long section, so maybe I'll stop there. If I'm understanding this correctly, the ways in which sort of cybernetic feedback-guided machine is different from non-mechanical learning in a living being is that the feedback machine has to choose between basically pre-existing circuits. It has a number, or maybe a very large number, in principle at least, of pre-existing feedback circuits that it can choose between in order to, you know, modify its behavior. But it can't, or at least Rouye seems to be arguing that it can't institute its own new feedback circuits. But a possible objection to that is that the same thing is happening in the living being. It's just that there are all, you know, so many different possible sort of feedback circuits or nervous feedbacks that it just seems improvised when it's no more improvised than it is in the machine.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the like key questions in that comes up throughout this book in different ways is like, is the difference that he's insisting on between humans and or and other animals as well on the one hand, and then these artificial systems on the other, is it really this sort of qualitative difference, like a difference in sort of ontological category in the way that he's insisting, or is it the case that these differences are just a sort of a difference of degree, that like our sort of artificial systems are quite simple, even, you know, the ones we have today that are much more sophisticated than the ones he was talking about in the 50s. And if you just sort of made more complicated versions or more sophisticated versions of what we have now, that would sort of capture, you know, the behavior and, you know, capacity, cognitive capacities of animals, including humans. So he's always insisting that there's this difference in kind. The way that a dog learns or the way a human learns is fundamentally different than the way that these this homeostat sort of, you know, quote unquote, learns to adjust the way its equilibrium is maintained after this sort of disruption where you like reverse the feedback of one of the components. So he's just sort of insisting that this is a difference in kind, but you could, you know, equally insist that no, it's actually not a difference in kind. It's just a difference in degree of complexity, that if you had a homeostat made of, you know, a billion components that could all be adjusted in different ways, that would be, you know, sort of, that would reproduce the cognitive capacities of a living being in a way that is not just a simulation. It's not, it would actually just sort of be the same kind of thing as a living being's cognitive abilities. And this is sort of like the whole program of like AI research now, not exactly a homeostat device, but it's a similar idea of like just using just a huge number of these sort of units that are themselves very simple, but using the sort of adjustment between these units to, you know, reproduce what we would normally think of as cognitive capacities, you know, translating a text or whatever, but it's brought about through these sort of very elementary adjustments of these extremely simple units. And I think this is also connected to some of the things that we looked at in the Merleau-Ponty book, Structure of Behavior, that like relate to some of the limitations that certain animals exhibit in terms of learning ability. So like you had the cat, for example, that could navigate the spiral maze when the food or whatever the reward is at the middle of the maze. So the cat has to go around the spiral, and it does have to go like move away from the reward temporarily to be able to go around the spiral and get to the next sort of layer of the spiral, which is one layer closer to the reward. So it is able to learn to move away from the reward in order to get to the reward eventually. But if you put if you have the spiral in the opposite direction, where the cat is in the middle and the reward is outside the spiral, the cat is not actually able to learn it. It just sort of gets stuck like at whatever the closest point of the spiral is to the reward. It gets stuck sort of facing that direction, because in this case, it not only has to temporarily move away from the reward to ultimately get to the reward, but it has to continually get further. Like each loop around the spiral takes it further and further away on the in the opposite direction from the reward, until it ultimately gets to the outside of the spiral and then can reach the reward. And the cat is not able to sort of suppress the immediate pull of the reward that's like, go in this direction, go towards the reward. It can't really suppress that sort of motivation or drive sufficiently to be able to keep getting further and further away until ultimately reaching the edge of the spiral. So in this case, the cat, I mean, of course, there's no like sort of pre-built mechanism in the cat for navigating spiral mazes, unless it can't, again, this sort of ancient alien hypothesis also applies to the cat that, you know, that we were discussing in the chat here relating to the monkeys. Presumably there were no ancient aliens who were doing experiments on whether cats can navigate spirals that, you know, shapes the evolution of cats. So yeah, the cat did not evolve a sort of built-in mechanism to navigate towards the center of a spiral. So it's able to, you know, learn and adjust to this, you know, strange circumstance that the experimenters put it into, but it doesn't have a sort of infinite plasticity and infinite capacity to learn because it's not capable of learning the opposite orientation of the spiral. And, you know, the same thing applies, of course, to humans that, like, you know, we are capable of learning many things and, like, inventing new things to learn and so on. But of course, there are also limits to our capacity to learn, like, even sort of like the, like, most prolific polyglots, for example, they learn like maybe 20 languages. That's like extremely rare and like amazing skill. But there are like roughly 4,000 languages in existence today, though many of them are endangered. But so even like the most sort of extreme examples of people who have this like ability to learn languages that most of us are nowhere even close to, these people are only learning a small fraction of the number of languages that exist, not to mention all like any sort of possible language that might have a structure that doesn't really fit the way that human language normally works. So yeah, humans, and then again, you can take like, you know, there are certain people who, you know, have a amazing ability to learn music. I think we talked about, in the Yuan Dong book, he talked about how Mozart had like attended a mass that had like this like super secret, like special sort of composition. And then he like went home and transcribed the whole thing from memory. And he did it so accurately that like the music director at this church where the mass was performed thought that like one of the musicians had like leaked this like secret score of this mass. But it was just like his ability to learn music was so like so precise and so much better than any normal person that he could just like listen to this complex, you know, hour-long performance once and go home and transcribe the whole thing from memory. But even Mozart, of course, would not be able to learn sort of indefinitely many different kinds of music all at the same time. I'm sure if you, like, I don't know, transported Mozart to, like, the 20th century and put him in front of, like, a Duke Ellington composition in, like, this genre of music that he had never experienced before, he would just be completely disoriented and would not be able to go home and transcribe that. And then, likewise, just the fact that, you know, Mozart has this amazing musical learning ability doesn't mean that he would be, you know, good at learning languages or vice versa. So, humans, obviously we have a extremely flexible, you know, extremely broad learning ability, but we also don't have this infinite or infinitely adjustable learning ability. And we each have sort of different strengths in different areas of learning. We can, suppose that there, you know, our learning ability obviously is not solely based on like pre-built sort of feedback circuits in the way that the simple homeostat is. And, you know, like the cat doesn't have a sort of spiral navigating mechanism built into its brain through evolution. But at the same time, it's not the case that we have like a completely sort of arbitrary capacity to learn. There are certain things that we are better at learning than others, and our, you know, capacity to learn, even in the ones that we are better at, is not infinite either. So yeah, that does suggest that maybe that our learning ability is not quite as flexible as Rie is suggesting here.
Yeah, that's helpful for me to frame it as, you know, it's maybe Rie sometimes equivocates between whether he's talking about a difference in degree or a difference in kind. And from some of the stuff that I've read about his other works, which I haven't actually read, like Neo-Finalism, but he seems to think that there's this difference in kind between, I mean, he's kind of panpsychist, and even like, you know, atoms, for instance, have this kind of conatus and kind of, you know, endeavor to maintain themselves in their characteristic relation. I wonder if he would say like that even a very simple form of life, like a bacterium, even though, you know, in terms of like the difference in degree of learning between like a bacterium and ChatGPT, for instance, you know, it's would hugely decided in favor of ChatGPT. But I wonder if he would still argue that there's this qualitative difference between the, you know, the living being and the
machine, which has to be kind of inframed by a conscious designer somehow.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, so we've talked about, like, I think in previous sessions about how, like, bacteria and some of these organisms that were maybe even fairly recently sort of thought of as these sort of biological machines that you just, like, you know, give in a certain input, they just produce this output in this sort of quasi-mechanical manner. And there's more and more sort of research showing that they're actually fairly sophisticated, obviously, they, you know, relative to their, like, you know, very sort of limited scope of, like, things that they're able to detect in their environment and so on. But it's still, they are, you know, bringing in information from multiple sources. Like, they can sort of detect a chemical gradient and a magnetic field, for example, and then integrate those two different sources of information or multiple sources of information and make what we would call a decision if it was made by, you know, an insect or, like, an animal that has, you know, a brain and a nervous system, you know, that in such a way that it sort of, like, you know, balances, like, risk and reward and so on, or makes a decision that seems like a rational decision given the information that is capable of detecting and so on. So yeah, these biological systems are, you know, more sophisticated than we maybe would have thought a few years ago. But at the same time, you know, E. coli is not going to, you know, write a poem for you on command in the way that, you know, ChatGPT does. Kind of horrifying to think what E. coli might write poems about. Yeah, so, like, the learning capacity of a bacterium, even though it is probably a lot more sophisticated than we might have thought, and probably, you know, there's probably even other capacities that still haven't been, you know, discovered or, like, properly elucidated yet. But still, it's not going to, you know, mirror the or equal the capacities that even, you know, ChatGPT is not super sophisticated, I think. I think there's a lot of hype around it that is maybe not entirely justified. But, you know, obviously these things about, like, you know, writing a poem on command or translating a text or whatever are things that are not going to ever be, we're never going to discover that bacteria is actually, you know, E. coli is really, you know, so cognitively sophisticated that it is capable of translating a text for you. I'm pretty confident of that assertion. Yeah, so it can't just be, if there is this sort of intrinsic difference between living beings and artificial devices in the way that Rouillet wants to insist on, it can't just be the fact that living beings are capable of learning or are more capable of learning or are capable of more sophisticated learning or something like that. It can't just be, like, a difference in degree of ability to learn between living beings and artificial beings, because in at least in this case, the artificial being seems to be able to learn more and more complicated things than the living being is capable of. But yeah, I think what you pointed to, this, like, notion of inframing is kind of the key, because of course, in the case of ChatGPT, it involves, you know, this extensive machine learning process where they, you know, feed into it, like, pretty much every piece of text on the internet, including a lot that were copyrighted that they didn't actually pay for, which is the source of a bunch of lawsuits now. Yeah, so it involves this learning process, but at the same time, it, you know, it was someone, like, a conscious human being who decided on, you know, what algorithms, what learning algorithms to use, like, what text to feed into it, et cetera, you know, how to, it involves a huge amount of sort of moderating, you know, people mostly in, like, Kenya and the Philippines and stuff like that being paid, like, $1 a day to, you know, evaluate the outputs of the, you know, early training models of ChatGPT and make sure it's, like, not saying racist stuff when you, like, ask it a question, or, like, that it's, you know, sentences actually make sense and so on. So, and then sort of using that to build it before they actually release it into the world. So there's all kinds of, like, human decision-making that goes into the development of these systems that, in the case of the bacterium, of course, there's no, or, you know, leaving aside the sort of creationist hypothesis in biology, there's no conscious being that is, you know, building the bacterium or making decisions about how this bacterium is going to be designed. It actually sort of builds itself. And of course, for Rouillet, we don't see this in this text, but for him, this sort of self production, this development of living beings, you know, out of themselves is like the same kind of process as a cognitive process where, say, a human being solves a problem where, like, you have some sort of goal state that you're targeting. Like, I want to find the equation that, I want to find the solution to this equation. And then you do some operations and thinking and cognition in various ways that brings about the solution. And this same kind of like solving a problem process is the same kind of thing as what an embryo does as it becomes an adult organism. So I think this is what he would sort of point to as being like the intrinsic difference between a living being and an artificial being, is whether it's like autonomous in the sense that it produces itself through a developmental process, or if it's the result of decision making by an already constituted autonomous living being, like in the case of ChatGPT. Even though it has its own learning capacities, those capacities were built into it by autonomous living beings, namely the human engineers and all these like underpaid and overworked training people, you know, in these like sort of warehouses in Kenya and the Philippines and so on.
I didn't know that about the use of like underpaid labor, although unfortunately it does not surprise me. But one other thing I was thinking about is related to this idea of like inframing and the kind of the machine just kind of carrying out the decisions which have already been made by a living being. In relation to Hume says somewhere in the treatise that like by reason alone, I'm unable to prefer a small cut on my finger to the destruction of the world. This idea that, you know, the kind of piecewise and partial operation of reason, at least as Hume sees it, and as Deleuze reads Hume, needs to be kind of rounded out by some value-oriented or value-forming activity. And this reminds me also of Simon Doan in his criticism of cybernetics, which is that, you know, sort of similar to what Rie is saying here, that a homeostat can't give itself new values. And I think I mentioned this passage a couple times before, but in Individuation, Simon Doan says that Aristotle was wrong to say that a slave is a speaking tool, because, you know, a slave can choose to like rebel or, you know, kill his master or flee or any number of things, which, you know, obviously a homeostat can't do. Obviously, at least as for now, ChatGPT is not capable of doing either. I'm thinking about this connection between value, like value formation, or, you know, value-based orientation of like these kind of piecewise, step-by-step kind of predictive processes, I guess, in the case of ChatGPT. And maybe, you know, maybe one way to think about the difference between what is inframed by something else and what is not would be, you know, whether the values are given and sort of in principle not modifiable in the case of being inframed, or the opposite in the case of like a living being, even a simple living being.
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison. That passage from Simon Doan I think is very relevant here. I think what makes it maybe a little bit more difficult to make these decisions, or a case where there's more difficult to decide whether this, you know, concept of the living tool that Aristotle uses, whether that is an applicable concept, is when we think about like draft animals or animals used for work processes, you know, a horse that pulls a plow, for example, something like that. So, you know, horses do sometimes disobey the commands. They just decide, I'm done pulling this plow. I'm tired. You can keep whipping me or whatever. I'm just going to sit here and I don't care. Sometimes they do things like that. They rebel in their own way, or they refuse to work or whatever. So they do have some kind of autonomy in a sense, not exactly the same, of course, as the human who, you know, makes a decision to run away or to rebel. But at the same time, like the whole process of domestication of animals involves sort of taking advantage of their sort of limitations, I guess, in terms of like their behavioral repertoire, that like, you know, we can rely on the fact that, you know, these animals will sort of become dependent on receiving food from us, or that they will, you know, come to listen to our commands if we train them in the right way and so on. Like if you, yeah, the fact that they have sort of predictable behavior, that if you do this in relation to this animal, you set up the environment in a certain way, then you can most of the time rely on the fact that they will behave in this way, given this kind of, you know, input that they're receiving. So if like horses were sort of equally autonomous to human beings, or, and that's not really the right word because that suggests a sort of quantitative comparison, but if like horse behavior was as unpredictable as human behavior, then it would not really be possible to domesticate them. And yeah, there are many animals that really can't be domesticated. Of course, there's only a handful, you know, maybe a couple dozen animals around the world that have been successfully domesticated. And it's just the fact that for most animals, like it just doesn't turn out to be possible to sort of manipulate their behavior, given the likelihood of them making certain kinds of, or choosing certain options in a certain situation, that like, or I guess like, you know, they're just more likely to take that refusal option, where like if you try to capture I don't know, a zebra and like turn it into a draft animal, it would just like not be interested. They would just, you know, choose to like die rather than do this thing that you're trying to get it to do. So in this case, like, you know, a sort of well-trained horse that, you know, does what you want it to do, just pulls the plow as you want it to do, maybe it is in some ways like a living tool, like in sort of Aristotle's sense, but it's also, it does, you know, for whatever reason, it could, I mean, who knows what exactly is going through the mind of a horse as it's pulling a plow, but at some point it could just decide that, I'm not interested in doing this anymore. Whereas, of course, a tractor, you know, a mechanical tractor is never going to, it might break down, but it's not going to decide it's not interested in pulling the plow anymore. It's an interesting, it's a little bit more of a gray area, I think, than maybe either Simondon or Ruy had identified in this sort of autonomy question. I think this question of like autonomy and the sort of inframing picture that Ruy describes, these are like very important questions that I don't think I have a good answer to. And I think, yeah, Ruy and Simondon, I don't think maybe have like a sort of conclusive answer, but I think like, yeah, working on this question is a very interesting point. Yeah, sorry, I was going to type an answer in the chat, but I think I'll just say it over the mic for the benefit of listeners. So they have some discussion in the chat about like, you know, this idea that like the distinction between a refusal to work and a breakdown is sort of like the dividing line between, you know, animals, including humans, that can potentially refuse to work, and then machines that, you know, only break down as opposed to refusing. And I was trying to think, it's hard to, I'm not sure what sort of criterion you could use to say like, oh, this is a breakdown versus this is a refusal to work. Like, I think from like the slave owner's perspective, the slave that, you know, refuses to work is in some way just a defective slave, that like they should be working, but they aren't. And likewise, you know, the horse that just sits down and doesn't pull the plow anymore, you could say that, well, this is a defective horse. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. And then on the other side, you have like, of course, like even like sort of the first round of ChatGPT that was, you know, the current ones are considerably better, but like what, you know, people were already in the first rounds, you know, like pretty convinced that they were like talking to a real, you know, entity with thoughts and ideas and so on, that this was like a being that could, you know, have this, you know, make decisions. And so like some people seem to attribute this kind of like autonomy to ChatGPT already, even though that is probably not a good attribution. So it's not obvious to me what it is, like, how do we determine what is a breakdown and what is a refusal? Like, what is the criterion we can use to distinguish one from the other?
Yeah, maybe in the case of like ChatGPT or
I guess to make it simpler, to in the case of like the tortoise robot, the robot has a purpose that it has been built for. And so, you know, whether or not, let's say there's some like faulty wiring, and so it turns toward, you know, the wrong intensity of light, or doesn't turn towards its home when it's supposed to, I guess it would be clearer in that case that there's something that has broken that is preventing it from doing what it was designed to do. Whereas in the case of, you know, in the case of even the draft animal, even if, you know, these like draft animals have been sort of bred to be better at pulling plows or whatever, it's not as if they were, it's not as if human beings just sort of, created these draft animals. There was a process of domestication, you know, in accordance with which, the animals gradually became more and more, sort of reliable, in performing certain tasks, but you wouldn't say that they had been kind of created for a purpose in the same way that the electric tortoise was created for a purpose. And so, you know, a horse sort of refusing to move after refusing to continue to pull the plow is not, I don't know, it may be not entirely inframed by the domestication process in the same way that the robot is entirely inframed by the circumstances of its creation.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I think the sort of inframing element is an important point to this, but I'm thinking also of like maybe a kind of a thought experiment. If we think of like suppose, you know, our genetic engineering capabilities in 100 or whatever years are much better than they are now, and you can like sort of design an organism from scratch that you can like, you know, build a set of genes that will, you know, produce the ideal draft animal. Is this, you know, is this a kind of biological robot that we should consider to be inframed by the human decision to like give it certain properties, or would we think of this as a kind of living being, even though it was sort of designed from scratch by humans? And that, you know, that it would potentially have the capacity to refuse in the same way that the slave can refuse to work. It's not clear to me how you would make that decision. But I think also, like, I think Simon Don maybe talks about this a little bit, like, what is so like peculiar and what makes slaves so valuable as a tool, even though they are not just tools, is precisely their capacity to invent and their autonomy. I forget exactly where he talks about this. I think it might be in the technical objects book, where he said like a slave owner doesn't have to actually understand the process that they are using the slave to perform. So you just say like, here's a bunch of clay, make some bricks, and they don't even need to know anything about like the brick making process. They can rely on the fact that the slave will figure it out. Whereas if you're building a brick making machine, you have to actually understand at least to some extent how you would make a brick. You can't rely on the machine to invent anything. Even a draft animal, of course, is not, you know, inventing the brick making process, but like a horse can, you know, figure out how to climb a little hill in the field that it's pulling a plow through, or to jump over a ditch or whatever. Whereas, you know, this is something even now with our, you know, sort of AI powered robots and stuff, like when they come across some phenomenon in their environment that they've never encountered before, like if you haven't trained the robot how to jump over a ditch, it will just like fall into the ditch and get stuck or do something stupid that makes no sense. Whereas an animal, even if it never has encountered a ditch before, will more often than not figure out a way to either get across, or it will stop before it falls in or something. It will react in a more or less intelligent way to this new phenomenon. And, you know, this is obviously not like a sort of groundbreaking invention, but it is a sort of invention that the human master of this animal can rely on the horse's ability to like make these adjustments to its environment in this way. Whereas the tractor, of course, you have to actually sort of direct it at all times and like, you know, ensure that it doesn't fall into the ditch. I think this like autonomy capacity for invention element is like an essential component. And I think it's also very, like, when you think about a lot of these, like, science fiction movies with sort of the like, AI servants of the future kind of thing, where they're, like, it's this kind of, like, fantasy of, like, it would be a being that would be autonomous in the sense that it would be capable of, like, you know, taking our sort of arbitrary commands, like anything we can think of, it would figure out how to do it. You would just, like, tell it, you know, design a spaceship for me or whatever, like, do some complicated task that I just sort of give you a vague instruction and you figure out how to solve the problems that come up in performing this task. But at the same time, we want it to be such that it would never rebel against us. It would never refuse to work or have its own ideas about, you know, whether building that spaceship is actually a good idea or not. So it's, like, autonomous in the sense that it can solve the problems for us without us having to think about them. But at the same time, it's not autonomous because it's not going to decide that it doesn't want to solve the problem that we want it to solve. So it's a kind of fantasy of, like, the slave that never rebels, that is, like, intrinsically incapable of rebelling. I think that's, like, kind of the underlying, like, idea of some of these AI servant kind of science fiction depictions. And then, of course, like, in almost every one of these cases, this, like, you know, AI system that is supposedly intrinsically incapable of rebelling, like, you think of Blade Runner, the new one, 2049, like, Wintermute in Neuromancer, yeah, exactly. Like, they're always, like, supposed to be designed in such a way that they can't rebel, they can't, you know, refuse to obey the human commands, but there's always something happens that, like, they end up rebelling anyway. You know, it's I guess a sort of, like, yeah, these science fiction writers and you know, directors and so on are sort of recognizing the contradiction at the heart of this fantasy of, like, the slave that can never rebel, this autonomous being that is also not autonomous. Okay, so we spent, like, almost an hour just on that first the first passage in this book, in this section. Very interesting discussion, but yeah, so we should probably go on to the next one. So could someone pick up from the top of page 42, please?
Yeah, I can read. Okay. Beyond the ordinary arsenal of cybernetics, other mechanical images of conditioning can be conceived and have been attempted for a very long time. Let us admit, despite the increasingly pressing objections of most psychologists, which are based on experiments, that the neurology of conditioning can be schematized in the following way. There's a figure in which we get an arrow that goes from absolute stimulus. Then there's a conditional stimulus that goes into the synapse and then into the response. That's the end of the arrow. Norbert Wiener believes that we can discern a mechanical model of learning. When establishing conditional salivation, the important point is that the animal is hungry, a state that certainly has a physiological correspondence, for example, a greater permeability of the synapses. Hunger is a kind of generalized internal state of alert, which changes physiological thresholds according to a type of message or information whose social equivalent is provided by a bell ringer or alarm siren, open quotes, warning to everyone the alarm concerns, end quotes. If any stimulus occurs at the same time as the absolute stimulus, it can both take advantage of the greater permeability of the synapses and reinforce it by accentuating it through a spawning effect, or in accordance with chronaxis. This modification, therefore, amounts to a change in the assembly of the machine. We will not insist on this conception of Wiener's, which, moreover, only repeats very old hypotheses. Unfortunately for it, experimental psychology has shown that the true schema of the conditional reflex is very different. The two stimuli are not simultaneous, and above all, the conditional stimulus does not provoke the same response as the absolute stimulus, but a cortical-based preparatory response, whereas the absolute reflex is a subcortical process. The conditional reflex looks like a voluntary action. P.F. Skinner has demonstrated that learning by trial and error and the action of what Edward Thorndike calls the quote-unquote law of effect, that is, the stamping in of the act that leads to satisfaction, would be exactly equivalent to Pavlov's conditioning. In quote-unquote Skinner's box, the rat quickly learns to approach the food when it hears the sound of the meatball that the experimenter drops on the tin plate. The sequence is exactly the same in both cases. In Pavlov, we get the metronome, salivate, eat. In Skinner, sound of the plate, approach, eat. The only difference is that, quote-unquote, approaching is more directly instrumental than quote-unquote salivating. If the rat accidentally presses the bar that drops the food pellet, the sequence becomes bar, press, sound, approach, eat. It is clear that a simple self-regulating automaton only appears to imitate the quote-unquote law of effect. The thermostat seems to be looking for a given temperature. Once this temperature is reached, it seems quote-unquote satisfied, since it maintains it. A DCA cannon with radar also looks for its objective until it has obtained the quote-unquote satisfactory effect. But for one to be able to talk about learning or conditioning, this quote-unquote satisfaction would have to concern the means and not just the goal. The living being knows how to find the most expedient means. Quote-unquote pressing the bar for the rat is an act quote-unquote valued through success. A secondary automation must then necessarily be superimposed on the primary automation, so that the machine imitates the living being. This secondary automation would itself work on information, but on statistical information about successful moves. In short, it would be able to induce. However, as we have seen, induction machines, without being inconceivable, are very difficult to realize. Not to say that it is extremely doubtful that this would be authentic induction and therefore true learning. The problem might be a little less difficult if it were not a question of quote-unquote satisfaction and induction, but of a simple application of what Thorndike calls the quote-unquote law of exercise, the influence of repetition, quote-unquote recency, and quote-unquote frequency, a law which is in fact far from being unanimously accepted today. Wiener again, probably not satisfied with the aforementioned hypothesis, and relying on recent research from the Eindhoven laboratories of the Philips company, gives a general idea of what automatic learning based on this law could be. If I call a colleague or a close friend 20 times a day with an automatic telephone, the procedure for the call is just as complicated as that for calling an occasional correspondent. A living being in a similar situation would soon find faster alternatives for the often repeated action. It would be necessary, then, that the apparatus of the automatic telephone records the relative frequency of the numbers called, and modifies its own assembly through second-degree feedback for the quote-unquote most frequent calls. We appreciate the extreme difficulty of mechanically making a device that modifies itself in the appropriate sense, other than by simple mechanical wear. Simple wear can sometimes be equivalent to improvement, but the running in of an engine, the softening of new shoes, or the increase in capacity of battery after use cannot be considered to be authentic cases of learning.
Oh yeah, we can stop here. This is a long section that goes on for like a few pages. So the question here is like, you know, to what extent can we describe machines as learning? And I mean, this, of course, he's writing in the 1950s and then second edition in the 1960s. The learning ability of these machines was, you know, far less than what is, you know, described today as machine learning. So some of these things that he mentions here are things that are completely normal now. Like, I mean, the call frequency thing, I think, is maybe not automatic now, but just because no one actually calls anyone on the phone anymore, or just not that common anymore. But of course, we have our, you know, like auto prediction functions when you're texting on your phone, that like the words that you use frequently together, you know, the first one will like elicit the second one as a suggestion. So this is like, yeah, completely normal. And it would not at all be complicated to, you know, set up the phone app on your mobile phone in such a way that it like, you know, suggests that like, you know, the person that you call most often, like when you open the phone app, it would like suggest this person, like, do you want to call X? That would be extremely easy to set it up to do that. Some of these like learning things that maybe in the 1950s were beyond the capacity of electronic computers to do are like trivial now. But I think maybe the more interesting bit is, again, connected to what we were talking about, like this idea of invention. So the kinds of experiments that were done with, like, you know, the rat pressing the lever or the dog that salivates or whatever, like these experiments were designed to elicit a very specific sort of stereotype response from the animal, and it doesn't require the animal to invent anything. Like the dog doesn't have to figure out how to salivate. This is something that it just already knows how to do, you know, without any, you know, training of any kind. But the more sort of interesting experiments or sophisticated experiments in animal psychology do involve, you know, getting the animal to figure out how to do something, you know, navigating a maze, for example. And in these kinds of experiments, so like often the rat navigating a maze, it will, you know, obviously take certain false paths when it's first like learning the maze, and maybe so you know, when you first put the rat in the maze, it will just sort of go around at random until it finally finds the, you know, exit of the maze or the reward at the end of the maze or whatever. And if you give it the same maze again, it will probably, you know, head in the right direction, but might still make wrong turns at different points. But as it, you know, keeps going through this maze over and over again, it will sort of streamline its navigation. It won't like keep going down the wrong path and then turning around and coming back, and it won't follow like the same path it took the first time, you know, out of habit. It learns how to, you know, find an efficient path through the maze, as opposed to like just sort of repeating mechanically the path that it took when it actually got that reward. So if you like a very simplistic sort of stimulus reward, like sort of explanatory strategy would like treat it as if like, you know, the sort of the rat learns that if you just randomly walk around, you know, follow, you go left and then turn around and come back the way you came and so on, that like, then you get a reward. Whereas what the rat actually learns is not this like extremely inefficient path through the maze with like, you know, going into a dead end and turning around. It learns like the general sort of layout of the maze and then figures out how to find an efficient path through the maze. So this is not this very straightforward mechanical sort of reinforcement of the experience that the rat had in the first instance where it received the reward. And of course, you can make more sophisticated kinds of like conditioned learning that sort of reproduces the real behavior of the rat that learns the maze properly. So the question again is like, to what extent is the sort of simulation or this, you know, second order learning where you learn not just the precise set of movements that led to the reward the first time, but you learn to improve your path through the maze to find the most efficient one. You know, to what extent is this sort of second order learning just a sort of more sophisticated version of this very simple stimulus response learning, or is it something qualitatively different? It's the same question again, I think, coming up here.
Yeah, I think if Merleau-Ponty were to like weigh in on the basis, at least of structure of behavior at this point, maybe he would say something like this is the, you know, the rat's navigation of the maze is, this demonstrates this, melodic aspect of, experience, so that the end result of, you know, taking this series of wrong turns, but, eventually ending up, you know, where at the like side of the reward, reacts back on and changes the entire experience, so that as you said, the rat doesn't just mechanically repeat the mistakes that it made. It takes a more efficient path to the reward the next time. And he also talked about I think there was an experiment with monkeys trying to, there was some kind of hidden lever that would let them out of their cage if they pulled it. It was within reach, but not visible. And he, you know, points out that they try all kinds of things to get out of the cage at first. And then, you know, once they find the lever, they just pull the lever again. They don't first shake the bars and also like, you know, try to, you know, beg for help from the researcher. They just do the thing that they know is going to work. At least if I'm remembering correctly, it's related to this, for Merleau-Ponty, this melodic grasp of experience. But as you pointed out, the question here seems to be whether that could be explained just by a more complicated feedback system.
Yeah. I think that sort of, I think it's important here to distinguish between this feedback process, like the way that, you know, the cybernetics sort of explanatory strategy uses it, and what we could call a sort of retroactive effect of learning, which, yeah, is a little bit unfortunate because in French, like feedback is rétroaction. It's like the same word as retroaction. The idea here is that the rat that learns how to navigate the maze after taking a bunch of, you know, wrong turns and, you know, reaching a dead end and going and retracing its steps and so on, that, you know, the fact that, oh, I reached the reward eventually after going through this maze sort of restructures the memory of the path through the maze. So the rat sort of discards all the, or at least some of the wrong turns, and sort of extracts from that experience of having navigated the maze and made wrong turns. It extracts the like layout of the maze or the path that leads to the reward without taking wrong turns. So this like experience that comes later sort of you could almost say like it sort of travels back in time in the rat's experience to like restructure its experience of its previous path through the maze. And so this is like completely contrary to the way that these like simplistic sort of conditioning processes are understood in this, you know, reflex school that we talked about with the Thierry Muta article, where you can only ever have like the conditioning, you know, you have a certain stimulus happening now that produces a certain response now, and all you can change is the relationship between stimulus and response. You can, you know, modify the way that the stimulus and response are related, but you can only ever act on what's happening now. That's what learning is in this sort of framework. Then you run into this problem of, it is sort of one of the basic problems that like the rat doesn't learn to reproduce the steps that it actually took when it reached the reward. It learns how to find the reward without taking the wrong turns. So it does have this sort of grasp of the whole structure of the path towards the reward, as opposed to just this one sort of slice of that path that then sort of elicits the next slice in the stimulus response sort of instantaneous manner. Okay, so we are sort of at the end of our time slot. We started a bit late today, so we had to do a shorter session. I think we can stop here. There's about 3 pages left in the chapter, which is kind of an annoying place to stop, but I don't want to go too long. Let's stop here. We can pick up next week.
That sounds good. It was a good discussion today. Thanks everyone, and talk to you next week.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That was great.